Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Everyone is talking about the impending snowstorm today. So before we get started on the program, I wanted to bring you this report on the weather from Christine Allen at WPSU in State College.
The bullseye for this storm right now looks like it's going to be east of Interstate I-99, north of the Turnpike, west of Interstate 81.
Meteorologist Marissa Ferger of Penn State says the worst of the storm will be tonight through early Thursday morning with very heavy snowfall.
It's going to make for some very dangerous travel. So if you do have to drive, I would suggest doing it earlier in the day because it is going to be falling very fast and very hard.
The storm will affect almost the entire state with snowfall predictions of up to a foot or more in many counties. I'm Christine Allen in State College.
Stay tuned to WITF. We will have the latest on the weather. And I just have to encourage everyone, stay safe. Take that advice that Christine and the meteorologist had about preparing and staying home if at all possible. Try to stay as safe, warm as you can. I mean, we're in the middle of a pandemic, a snowstorm with up to 2 feet of snow. It's unusual to begin with, but during this time in 2020, it is especially unusual. Coming up later in the program, what are older Pennsylvanians who would go to adult care centers before the pandemic? What are they doing now since these centers have been closed? And a local woman who became a best-selling author with her debut book. But up front, since May, Capital Region Water is one of about 400 systems nationwide that is participating in the testing of sewage for the COVID-19 virus. The tests are actually conducted by an MIT research firm, BioBot Analytics. The tests are used to determine the presence of the virus in a wider swath of the population and can be used to determine trends in the number of COVID infections. Capital Region Water will be working with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in research into sewage and COVID. Joining us on today's program is Charlotte Katzenmoyer, CEO of Capital Region Water, and Jess Rosenstell, who is Director of Wastewater Operations with Capital Region Water. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me, Scott.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk at WITF.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, Charlotte Katzenmoyer, we spoke about this, you, Jess, and I, last June, about a month after you started in May. This was relatively new. I guess you still could call it new, even though we're 9 months, 10 months into the pandemic. For those who aren't familiar with how this works, would you describe how you could, what sewage can do, what it can tell us about the COVID-19 virus?
Thanks, Scott. So recent research underscores the difference that wastewater testing can provide for COVID-19 surveillance. A recent Yale study measured the RNA concentrations from the coronavirus in primary sewage sludge in New Haven, Connecticut in a 10-week period. And those results showed that wastewater testing led hospitalizations by 1 to 4 days and positive tests by approximately 1 week. Other reports show that stool shedding will precede respiratory shedding. So that early shedding plus the short residence time in a sewer network plus rapid testing by either BioBot or the new provider that the CDC has contracted with means that we may be able to detect changes in the incidence in a few days versus the clinical indicators that can lag up to 2 weeks. So wastewater surveillance can really help local public health agencies to make decisions, particularly around whether to reopen or to take measures to curtail certain activities on a regional basis rather than across a state or even a county level. Because the sewer shed that we're testing in can be much smaller scale.
Has it been used that way, though? When you say that, the Yale research shows that it can foretell, something coming up, or a trend coming up 1 to 4 days ahead of time. Have you or some of these other systems, wastewater systems, used it that way, though?
Well, I think that the CDC, early on, they were really trying to get state agencies to take the lead on this and really do it on a statewide basis, since, most state agencies have Department of Health that can lead this effort. I think, as far as I know that Ohio has done this on a statewide level. We were trying to do it here in Pennsylvania, didn't get much traction. I think that now the CDC is stepping in and saying, okay, we need to get this more comprehensively across the country. So they've started this program to get about 10% of the population across the country under this national wastewater surveillance system during phase one. And then hopefully expand it to phase two and then have 30% of the country under this surveillance system.
So just to clarify, with the CDC involved, and maybe it will be taken, expanded a little bit more across the country with the CDC involved, what do we learn? What do municipalities, what do regions, what do states learn from this wastewater?
So it can really serve as an early warning system to provide public health agencies in each state to look at this data and be able to forecast when spikes are occurring. So, for instance, prior to this last surge, we may have been able to see the spike coming, which we kind of saw with our testing that we were doing since May at Capital Region Water. You could see the trend going up. So you're really able to forecast those spikes or those surges in cases and give your hospitals a heads up that a surge may be coming, or give local agencies the opportunity to look at certain different protocols or closings, or give a heads up to schools. So really use it as an early warning system.
Why didn't it gain traction, to use your words, in Pennsylvania with the state?
I think that most state public health agencies had a lot on their hands just dealing with the pandemic at the local level. I think that it just takes leadership, at a national level to really get a program like this underway. The states just had too much on their plate.
If you're just tuning in, our guest, during this portion of the program, Charlotte Katzenmoyer, your CEO of Capital Region Water, and Jess Rosenstiel, his Director of Wastewater Operations with Capital Region Water. If you have a question or comment, we have a few minutes left in the segment. Give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are @smarttalkWITF. So, Jess Rosenstiel, how does this work? How does Capital Region Water walk us through the process of what you do to surveil, to use that word, the wastewater?
Sure. Yeah, the surveillance system that we use for this project is the very same surveillance system we use for analyzing a variety of different contaminants that enter our treatment facility. Going back a little bit, our treatment system consists of almost 130,000, population of 130,000 people. And there's a network of pipes that connect to homes and businesses all throughout Harrisburg and several outlying municipalities. Of course, it gets conveyed down here through a variety of pipes and pumps. By the time it gets here to our sampling point, It's a clear grayish, dirty water. The solids have been pulverized large debris removed. And what you're left with is about 99.98% water. So very small solids content, but it does contain the RNA strands of COVID-19, and that's what they're analyzing. We have automatic composite samplers, which is basically just a machine that takes sips of what's coming into our facility every 20 minutes over a 24-hour period. We take that sample and ship it out to Massachusetts to BioBot Analytics. They analyze that sample for the overall concentration of the RNA strands of the SARS-CoV-2. And based on that analysis and the concentration in that sample, you can estimate about how much of those virus strands came into the plant over that 24-hour period. And knowing your flow into the plant and the concentration of virus, you can make an estimate on what the infection rate is in your general service territory. As Charlotte mentioned, we've been tracking this since early May, and we have an excellent correlation between the results that we get from the wastewater surveillance and the actual numbers of positive tests that we see in Dauphin County. We don't have it broken down to just our service territory, but we're nearly half of the population of Dauphin County. So that's what we compare it with. And the correlation is remarkable. When we see the concentration level make a significant increase, we know that we're going to see that in the next 7 to 10 days in the numbers pouring in from Dauphin County on positive test results. It's shown to be very reliable.
Jess, I'm curious, your service area, can it be broken down even into geographic areas, knowing where, for example, there are more pockets of positive COVID cases, or is this just because it becomes part of the whole system that you aren't able to do that?
Yeah, no, with additional equipment, we certainly can do that. There are strategic points throughout our wastewater collection system that would be excellent places to run a 24-hour composite sampler and get those small, tiny samples of water over a 24-hour period. That would be able to tell you the prevalence in a certain neighborhood, for instance. But there's been use of this technology on an even more granular level. There are instances where they're testing the wastewater effluent or the sewage being discharged from nursing homes in colleges. Back in September, the University of Arizona did sewage surveillance on their campus dormitories, and they had virus detected in one particular residence hall. So they took, with that information, they decided to test every student there, 311 students, and found two asymptomatic individuals who, of course, they isolated, and they likely prevented a lot more spread. So when you think about the applications, it can be in nursing homes, in large structures, workplaces. It can go all the way down to buildings and even neighborhoods. So
are there places in Dauphin County that you can tell us about right now that you were able to detect were experiencing higher positivity rates?
I cannot. I'm not aware of any in Dauphin County that are doing any wastewater surveillance for COVID on individual structures. We were interested in a pilot program with Harrisburg University at one point. I think there was a funding issue with that, but we are going to start a pilot program to kind of reach out into the community and see what kind of data we can collect on a daily basis, just to see how far upstream we can go in order to detect from a particular area.
Mm-hmm. Charlotte Katzenmoyer, when we spoke back in June, the headline at the time was that your sewage surveillance was showing 10 times more cases than what was reported by the Department of Health. What about now? I mean, is it consistent, or are you still showing more cases, less cases than what's being reported by the Department of Health?
It's still trending the same way. So we see that trend correlate with the testing that is being done by the Department of Health. And it is still in that range of tenfold. And, you know, we, as Jess said, we see it ahead of that testing. So we can forecast those case counts going up on a weekly basis. So it correlates very well. And I think other studies have shown that as well.
So just to clarify, what your surveillance is showing is that in Dauphin County, there are 10 times as many cases as has been reported by the Department of Health.
Jess, you can correct me if I'm wrong.
The BioBot case estimate changed at one point in the fall. And instead of estimating the total number of cases that they would estimate in your service territory, they actually changed it to the expected new case load per day. So that has increased and shows an increase of at least twofold over what gets reported, two to threefold over what gets reported. It kind of accounts for the fact of there's people that have already been infected and they're still shedding virus for some period of time. So to make it more manageable, they developed a system of estimating what you would expect the new infection rate to be per day. And again, since it's being done in wastewater and this virus is shed by asymptomatic people as well, you're looking at a number that's much higher than what you end up seeing in the from the testing centers.
Well, you see, that's just it. That's one of the keys, is that the state and what's being reported can only they only can report people who have been tested, where you're showing is that people right. who may have been tested or may not have been tested. Charlotte, I saw right. the Excel document that you had, and it showed that toward the end of October, the line was pretty flat for the number of cases, and then toward the end of October, I don't want to use the word exploded, but it really, really went up. I mean, so what did you do? What did Capital Region Water do? Who did you let know what's going on once you saw that line go way up?
Yeah, so Jess provides this based on BioBot's testing. He puts this Excel spreadsheet together, and we share it with local emergency management officials, with City of Harrisburg, with the Department of Health, and other agencies locally. So we're hoping that they use that and that Excel spreadsheet and showing that trending upward to put in place new protocols. I know from our own, for the safety of our own essential utility staff, we ramped up, encouraging staff to mask and social distance. I feel, we all felt like it was getting kind of lax, through the summer. That sometimes you would see staff and they wouldn't have masks on. So we explained to them the trends that we're seeing, and that we might be going into a fall surge. And we really encouraged them and really ramped up our vigilance in ensuring that our staff wore their mask and socially distanced. And we also considered whether we needed to go back into some split shifts, which we had done at the beginning of the pandemic, which now we're back into that split shift over the holidays with that surge in cases that we're seeing. And with some of our own essential employees, we've had some positive cases, which we did not experience early on in the pandemic. So it just helped us to reinforce the need to take those protocols seriously.
Charlotte, I'll also add that as Charlotte mentioned, we share this information with the Pennsylvania Department of Health, and they've indicated in emails that they use this information in a decision-making toolbox, so to speak. It's certainly not the end-all be-all and the only thing you're going to consider, but that it's a piece of information that they find valuable. I can't tell you what how high of a value they assign to it or how much weight, but they do take this information into consideration. Of course, they're making decisions for an entire state, and this is a small service territory, comparatively speaking. But it's good to know that. The fire chief in Harrisburg, Brian Enterline, is always interested in what the results are, perhaps to make sure first responders are well aware and taking extra precautions when they're out dealing with medical issues. So it's being used. I think we wish it was being used more and from a statewide level, like the network that Charlotte spoke about in Ohio. I know Michigan has a statewide network. Pennsylvania had introduced some legislation back in September, which was trying to set up a network in Pennsylvania to detect COVID-19. And unfortunately, that legislation died with the end of the legislative session. But there have been some efforts. So it's really encouraging to see it, as Charlotte mentioned, on the federal level, on across the United States. 30% of the population of the United States is an excellent sample size for something like this. And as we hopefully crest this wave and things go down, this network would be able to detect that and would give us more confidence in opening up. And you know, even looking into the future, setting up a network like this, you might have you might keep this network in place. I'm certainly nobody wants to hear about the next pandemic, but if this network is set up and in place, and as soon as you unlock the genetic code of whatever virus might be coming our way, we could immediately start a surveillance program for that and have a much easier time isolating than we did this time around.
One final question, just a quick question. You said crested, Jess. Has this crested yet from your observations?
From our sampling, no, it has not. It's been increasing aggressively. I think you mentioned the chart that I create and I update. We take our Sunday sample, which finishes sampling on Monday morning. We take that sample and overnight it to BioBot Analytics. They usually have a result for us the next day, which is today, Wednesday. So I'm always eager to see that email pop up in my inbox to see whether the number's higher or lower. And I have my fingers crossed that maybe it'll go down a little bit since last week. So really, really hoping that that's what we see. But unfortunately, we have not seen that just yet.
Charlotte Katzenmoyer is CEO of Capital Region Water, and Jess Rosenstell is Director of Wastewater Operations with the company, the system. Thank both of you for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Scott.
Thanks so much, Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. For many older Pennsylvanians and their families, adult day service centers are an invaluable part of their lives. Adult day services, also called adult care, are usually open during normal work hours. Unlike senior centers, which are usually sponsored by recreation departments and targeted at healthy older adults, adult day services are a resource for people with physical limitations or limited functioning due to memory loss. The majority of these centers in Pennsylvania closed in March, leaving vulnerable seniors largely forgotten. Joining us is Leslie Gilman, who is president of the Pennsylvania Adult Day Services Association. Ms. Gilman, welcome to the program.
Morning, Scott. Thanks for having me.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Leslie Gilman, describe what adult day services are and what they do.
Well, before the pandemic, all of our programs, and there are about 240 centers in Pennsylvania, serving about 16,000 adults. So we have quite a few people to be concerned about during this pandemic. But before the pandemic, our seniors were attending centers, getting medical oversight by a nurse, medication management, treatments, personal care, including assistance with toileting and showers, nutritional meals, and stimulating activities. And most important, they were able to engage with others. They did things like exercise, crafts, music, many things. And for those with dementia, which is memory loss, it's critical that they have the structure of that daily routine of a day and that they have that stimulation to keep their brain functioning.
So these centers that you referred to, have most of them, have all of them been shut down since March?
Well, they were all shut down in March, but subsequent to that, towards the end of June, some of them were able to reopen, not all. But when they reopened, they were needing to follow, obviously, certain protocols, and which included social distancing. So none of the centers could bring back all of their people in order to maintain those distances. But lately, as of the last month and a half, the numbers are exploding in terms of the virus. It's just raging. So what's happened is now the state has put out guidance based on the positivity rate. So what they're advising centers is to close or reclose if they've opened, if they're the positivity rate is over 10% in their county. Well, as of now, and just over the last, 4 weeks or so, that positivity rate has skyrocketed. In the whole state, the positivity is over 16%. So we have centers all closing back up for the most part. There are a few that are open that have put in some mitigation efforts to try to stay open, but it's very, very difficult and risky. So most centers really are closing, and the state is advising them to.
See, you sent an email, your organization sent an email to me when I first read it. The first thing that came to my mind is that this has to be a real challenge, a monumental challenge, with working with adults who may be living with a disability, a physical disability, or with memory loss, even in normal times. But now you were just describing how difficult it is with social distancing, masking, that kind of thing. The people who are your clients, how are they living? How are they getting by during this pandemic?
It's so difficult, Scott. The seniors are just stuck at home, and they are absolutely declining rapidly. Because, for memory, there's an expression, use it or lose it, and it certainly applies here. So if they're not getting the benefit of the routine of the center and attending the center and the stimulation that can be provided, they're slipping away. And they desperately need both medical management and stimulation to thrive. And they're just not getting this currently, being stuck at home. And the impact on families as well is devastating. It's turning families upside down, and it's really heartbreaking. I mean, most families are just not equipped to provide this level of care and the structure to the day. You know, when you're at home, your day is mostly unstructured. So it's very hard to create the same type of routine at home for these folks. And the families are falling apart. I mean, they can't do this on day in, day out basis, and they are just thoroughly exhausted after 9 months of trying.
You have tried to continue some services, though, via video, that kind of thing. I would imagine it's just not the same, but what have the centers continued to do to try to engage your clients?
So that is the solution. The solution here for Pennsylvania is what other states surrounding us have already put in place back in April, really, like New Jersey, Maryland. Adult day centers need to be reimbursed to provide remote services to the seniors. I mean, currently in Pennsylvania, those centers that are closed mostly have their staff furloughed. They're not operating. And it takes some resources to be able to pull off a remote program. But a remote program is the solution here. I mean, it's not perfect, but it definitely will help. And, you know, there's a lot that can be done through virtual means. So we can do telehealth with the nurse. All the centers have nursing care, so they have nurses. So we can provide telehealth through the center nurse and contact that family, contact that participant, and assess and monitor their well-being. This is critical because we need to all help to keep people out of hospitals. I mean, as of yesterday, Pennsylvania crossed a horrible mark, which is we now have 6,000 people hospitalized with COVID. So the last thing we want to do is have these seniors add to the crowd in the hospital and tax that hospital system. So if we can just do telehealth with the nurses, that would really help to make sure they're taking their medications, to pick up on maybe different symptoms that they might be having that the nurse could kind of nip it in the bud or contact the doctor, get a different medication, different things like that that could avoid a worse decline. And then if we could also do virtual activities, we could provide some stimulation for them, something to look forward to, something to expect a couple times a day, to tune in, to do exercise, to have music, to even with all the technology we have today, we could, you know, they could see their friends on Zoom and different things like that. A lot of people have, I mean, some don't, but a lot of people have means at home with either laptop or iPad or iPhone, and they could be doing these things, but it costs a little bit of money and we need to be reimbursed to do it.
Okay, so where do managed care organizations come into this?
So what we have been doing as PADSA, the state association representing all these centers, we've been working very closely with the state. And the managed care companies, there are three in Pennsylvania, they are the gatekeepers of the service. So they authorize the services for adult day for participants to attend the centers. They would also need to authorize remote services. And they are the ones that pay us for adult day care. So that's where they fit in. They are really the payer source. And there are three of them in Pennsylvania. But PADSA has been working very closely with the state because there hasn't been a mechanism to provide remote services and reimburse for it. And the state applied to CMS, which is the federal government, to get approval for adult day centers to be paid for remote services during the pandemic. And just as recently as last week, we learned that this was approved. So this is a great step forward. But putting it in sports terms, Scott, it probably puts us at the 50-yard line. We still have a lot of work to do with the state and the MCOs to kind of make it happen. We have to get a reimbursement model delivered to cover the center's costs and to provide the remote services, and it has to be authorized and implemented. So there's still quite a bit of work to do, but it's a very great step that has taken place as of last week.
I understand that one of the issues that you're dealing with is encouragement to switch many of these people to home care aides. What's the difference, and why do you feel they're better off utilizing an adult care center?
Well, oftentimes they need both and they work well together. So before the pandemic, a home care aide may come to the home, get them ready to get on a bus, to come to the program, et cetera. So they can work very well together. Now, during the pandemic, it's not enough just to have an aide come to the home to wash them up and get them dressed. You know, an aide is not the same as a professional nurse. So what I was speaking to about, speaking about having a professional nurse do telehealth calls, that really gets to the medical end of things. And to do virtual activities with that are therapeutic with trained activity staff, that really will address the level of boredom and will address the need for that stimulation and a routine and being part of and belonging to their friends at the center.
Well, it's good news that funding hasn't been approved, but, you know, just an observation, we're 10 months into this, it would seem that time is of the essence and that many of these people can't wait much longer. So hopefully it does happen soon. Leslie Gilman, she's president of the Pennsylvania Adult Day Services Association. Ms. Gilman, thank you very much for being with us today.
You're welcome, Scott. Thank you.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar.
For a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross.
Coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk, part of the program, we'll be updating you on the storm and its aftermath, what the roads look like, the weather forecast, maybe talk to the Pennsylvania Emergency Management Agency. That's all coming up on tomorrow's program. Hummelstown resident and author Kate Bear's debut book of poetry, What Kind of Woman, achieved a huge milestone on its release. It was number one on the New York Times bestseller list. In the first week, the book was out. It's a book of poetry and whose content many people can relate to. Joining us is Kate Bear, best-selling author Kate Bear. Ms. Bear, welcome to the program.
Hi, Scott. Thank you so much for having me. I listen to you every morning, so this is truly thrilling.
Well, I'm honored that you listen every morning. Thank you very much. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. First of all, congratulations. What were your thoughts when you found out that your debut book, the first week it was out, debuted at number one?
Yeah, I was shocked. I was surprised that so many people would embrace poetry. It was a huge shock to me, but really, really fun. I had, as you can imagine, low expectations for putting out a book in 2020, and it surpassed all of them for sure.
Why do you say you were surprised that a book of poetry would do so well?
Well, I don't know. I guess people have historically turned to poetry in times of grief. You know, Mary Oliver wrote, "We shake with joy, we shake with grief. What time they have, these two housed in the same body." And I think poetry gives permission for that to happen. And I do think that's true. I also think, you know, it's a difficult time for the economy. And I was just, you know, trying to keep my expectations low. And I also, you know, things like a book tour and all that stuff was canceled. So I tried to really keep my expectations in check. But it's been such a wonderful response. And I'm really grateful for that.
Okay, a book tour. I'm picturing a book tour, though, with four kids and a husband. How would you have pulled that off? How would you have pulled that off?
Yeah, there's some silver linings there, not lining up all that child care. Yeah.
Well, like many poets, your poems are about your life with your husband and four children. I would think it takes a special kind of person and talent to be creative and write poetic words about something that most people say is, well, this is life. This is what we do every day. In other words, you probably see life differently than most. Now, you can't compare because it's your life and your eyes that you're seeing it through. But I mean, do you think of yourself that way, that you're looking at your life, that so many other people probably have similar lives, but that you are looking at it through different eyes?
I don't know about different eyes. I do think that a lot of literature, you know, some people find the topic of motherhood kind of unliterary, which is kind of ridiculous, as, you know, everyone has a mother for better or for worse. And, you know, there's so many books written about topics like baseball and that, that aren't maybe as universal and kind of heralded as classics. And, I think, you know, people, women especially, want to feel seen in their bodies and in their marriages and in their own lives. And I do think, you know, that that has been part of the response to this.
Well, maybe it's because, I don't know, many mothers don't see themselves as inspirational when maybe they should. Where do you get your inspiration?
I mean, I think right now, when mothers are kind of largely ignored and expected to shoulder the brunt of childcare and domestic responsibility, I think, you know, I think some of the inspiration is, you know, kind of confirmation of worth and kind of looking at what's really happening behind the scenes.
I mean, when you are at home and you're working, taking care of the kids, your husband is a medical resident, I understand. I mean, do you look at something and say, do words come to you first, or do you look at something and say, you know what, I could probably come up with a poem about that?
That's a great question. Yeah, I think, you know, as I think a lot of writers would say this, a lot of the inspiration and ideas behind the pieces come to me during just a regular day and during kind of physical tasks. And I often just kind of email myself topics and ideas. The actual structure of writing, you know, writing a poem and the kind of discipline behind sitting down and writing it, that comes kind of in a quieter moment during work time, kind of figuring out the pacing and the language to it. It's almost like a separate thing. Those two things kind of happen separately, at least for me.
Do you write notes to yourself? I mean, we have heard of cases where writers or journalists will be in bed at night and something will pop into their head and they'll lean over, turn the lamp on and write a note to themselves to remember it. Do you do anything like that?
Yeah, I did it last night. Yeah.
Oh, really?
I do that all the time. Sure. Yeah. I often just open. I just quick grab my phone and email myself. It feels like the best way not to lose it.
Okay, I had to. You modernized it a little bit. I guess people don't turn the lamp on and write it anymore on a notepad. You took a bit of a different route to best-selling author. You wrote poems, posted them on social media, Instagram. Tell us about that. How did you start, and when did you know that this was more than just a few friends saying, "Hey, I like your poems"?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I always felt like I always read poetry, but I felt like I couldn't write it. I thought I had to be some like grad student smoking a pipe and wandering around the streets of Venice.
You needed a sweater.
And then I kind of just went for it. I don't know. Yeah. Mary Oliver had just died and I was, you know, rereading her books and realized how much I love this kind of boiled town like storytelling. And I started cheating on my novel and, you know, the result was kind of thrilling. I was probably like 35 pieces in before I started to realize that maybe they were part of a collection and, you know, things started falling in place. But yeah, it was not on purpose.
You know, one of the things I read an article about you in Vogue, and one of the things that was pointed out in that article was that some of unfortunately, anyone on social media, but someone who has as big a following as you, there will be trolls, there will be people who will say negative things. You did something a little bit different in that you engaged those people. Why?
I mean, yeah, for a while I was just deleting them. And, you know, then one day I was kind of looking at at something someone had sent me, and the words were kind of rearranging in front of me. I don't know how else to describe it. And I thought, what if I just kind of turn this into like a blackout piece and kind of flip the narrative? And it was really fun. It really took back the power took back the power through the words. And I don't know how long I'll keep up with that, but right now it's really fun to kind of turn something hateful into something, you know, worth reading.
What are some of the issues that you address in your poetry? And by issues, that's kind of subjects, I guess would be a better word than issues.
I think, yeah, like I said, you know, women feeling seen in their bodies and in their marriages and in their own lives. I think it's kind of broken into three sections, and those are kind of the themes in each section. Motherhood and womanhood are pretty big themes.
Now, this kind of relates to the question I asked earlier about whether the words come first or what. But do you make a conscious effort to say, okay, here is an issue or a topic I'm addressing, or does that come later? Do you, after the poem is written, you say, oh, okay, this fits under this category, or someone could put this under this category?
I have to say it's really difficult to say, I don't know, I'm going to write about Burger King and then write a poem about Burger King, if that makes sense. It's usually like, I mean, I've never written a poem about Burger King. Maybe that'll come, but you know what I'm saying? It usually is. It's kind of coming, the theme usually comes through towards the end. And obviously there are times when I'm thinking about a theme, like I said, I'll email myself a line or something I'm thinking about, but usually that kind of comes last. That's a very chicken, you know, or the egg question that a lot of people grapple with. And I think it's a mixture of both, but for me, it usually comes after.
Whopper, Whopper, single or double. We only have a couple minutes left, and I would be remiss if I didn't ask you to read us one of your poems.
I absolutely will. I usually pick from the popular ones, but you know what? Today I decided to pick one based on the theme, since we're near Christmas. This one's called Mary's Disappearance. Someone keeps stealing Mary, first from the porcelain set bought on a holiday, then in roadside nativity scenes. She has been removed, disappeared from the mall store window, the church's glass, Aunt Miriam's table set. Have you noticed, I say to anyone who will listen, that all the Marys are gone? No one answers or tries to listen. Let's not talk politics. My nephew's plastic set sits above the fireplace. Where is the mother, I ask, turning over every figurine. But the wise men keep their silence, begging us to ask if, in fact, she ran.
Mm. Kate, that's beautiful. And, you know, the thing I really like about it, and I'm sure that your fans do as well, is that it gets you thinking. It's almost like an observational. Would you agree that it's kind of that thing, the things that you notice that maybe others don't, that get people thinking?
Yeah. It's so hard to step outside of yourself and, you know, and look at that, but I think so. Yeah. this one actually came, I passed a roadside nativity scene and I didn't see Mary. And so this one was literally stemmed from that last Christmas.
Well, I have to tell you that now that I've heard your poem, I will be looking for Mary in all the nativity scenes.
Please report back.
Well, Kate Bear, she's author of the number one bestseller, What Kind of Woman? The book is on sale at bookstores, including you can get some autographed an autographed copy at the Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg. Kate, so great talking to you today, and best of luck, and again, congratulations.
Thank you so much, Scott. It was so great to be here.
I hope that she writes, you know, since Kate does listen to Smart Talk, maybe there's a Smart Talk poem there somewhere. But is it a good thing to suggest to a poet that they write a poem? I don't know. Not a good thing. I'm Scott Labar. Have yourself a good day. Stay safe.